On this edition of Celebrating Science, John Ellis and Robert Orr on the Large Hadron Collider. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, the Large Hadron Collider, world's most powerful microscope, John Ellis and Robert Orr explore the world's largest particle accelerator and its ability to probe the structure of the smallest particles of matter. A fellow of the Royal Society, John Ellis has written over 700 articles and is responsible for popularizing the phrase, theory of everything. Robert Orr teaches at the University of Toronto and is one of the world's leading particle physics researchers. He's also the winner of the 2006 Orion Discovery Award of Merit.
Good evening, and I'd like to thank very much John Matlock and his team at Perimeter for giving me the opportunity to come and share with you the fantastic adventure which we're preparing at CERN. So CERN is located over here on the outskirts of the town of Geneva, which is very close to the French border. In fact, our protons have to show their passports several million times a second. So the microscope which I'm going to introduce to you this evening is located in this red ellipse here. This red ellipse is a tunnel which is about 100 meters underground and 27 kilometers in circumference. So it's a particle accelerator. I'll say a little bit more what that means in a moment. It's to be contrasted with this aeroplane accelerator over here, which is the runway of Geneva Airport. So what are we trying to do at CERN? What are we trying to do with this project called the Large Hadron Collider? What are we trying to do in the experiments that Bob will be discussing with you in more detail in a moment? Well, simply put, we're trying to understand the nature of matter and, indeed, the universe itself. Now, when I was a research student, I pinned up on my wall a reproduction of this painting by Gauguin. And those of you who know it will remember that there are three fundamental questions that Gauguin asks in this picture. Where are we coming from, if you like? What is the origin of the universe? What are we? What is matter made of? Where are we going? What will happen in the future in physics and, of course, in the universe as a whole? So I use this picture to remind me of why it was that I used to go to work every day. And what I'd like to share with you this evening is how we're doing now in this quest. So sometimes when people hear about these physics experiments, these big accelerators, they think, well, you know, this has nothing to do with me. That is not the case. All matter, including you, even me, is made of the same constituents. And over the years, over the decades, over the centuries, I might almost say over the millennia, we've come quite some way in this quest. It was the Greeks who originally postulated the idea of atoms. It was discovered somewhat over a century ago that these atoms are actually complicated objects in which there are electrons which you can regard as orbiting around a relatively compact nucleus in the center. In the last century, around 1930, it was discovered that these nuclei, in turn, made out of simpler objects, protons and neutrons. And one of the big advances during my own career as a physicist has been the discovery that these protons and neutrons are, in fact, not simple elementary particles, but they're, in fact, complicated objects made out of more elementary things that we call quarks. And it's those quarks which are currently the limit of our knowledge. So what we particle physicists try to do is try to understand what these elementary particles are, the electrons, the quarks, and so on, and what are the forces between them? What holds, for example, the quarks inside the nucleus? What holds the electron in orbit around the nucleus, and so on? So in principle, every aspect of matter is derivable from the fundamental laws of physics, which we're studying with accelerators such as that at CERN. For example, all the different elements are made out of atoms. Those atoms are made out of nuclei, which contain these protons and neutrons. And as I said, at CERN, it is our job to understand what is the intimate structure of these building blocks of matter. Now, one should also bear in mind what the fundamental forces are between these different building blocks of matter. So the most familiar one is electromagnetism. Electromagnetism, electricity, magnetism, it's also responsible for light, for radio waves. This is, I think, familiar to most people. The strong nuclear force is the force that holds nuclei together. Something has to keep those protons and neutrons together inside the nuclei. We also know that sometimes these nuclei break apart. This is what we call radioactivity, perfectly natural phenomenon. In fact, it's the combination of the strong and nuclear forces that provide the energy that drives the sun and keeps us warm. Well, maybe not here this evening. Sometimes the sun comes out and keeps us warm. And here I'd like to acknowledge the work of the Snow Laboratory, which is not so far away from here, which has done some absolutely crucial experiments over the last few years to establish, beyond a shadow of doubt, the way in which the sun produces its energy. Then the final force in our roster is a gravitational force, which, of course, is responsible for holding planets in orbit around stars, stars together in galaxies, and so on. Now, much of what we know about particle physics, particularly in the first half of the last century, came from studies using cosmic rays. These were first discovered about a century ago. And on the left here, you see Hess, the discoverer of cosmic rays, about to go up in his balloon to discover these things showering down from outer space. So studies in the first half of the last century showed that many different types of particles were produced in these cosmic rays in tremendous showers that are triggered when an energetic cosmic ray strikes the upper atmosphere. However, it was realized around 50 years ago that if you wanted to study all these particles, if you wanted to study the structure of matter systematically, then you would need to build equipment in the laboratory to do so, and that's how particle accelerators such as CERN were born. So what do we do with these accelerators? Well, basically, we bang particles together. So here is a generic experiment. This is the sort of experiment that we were doing in the last decade at CERN, also with Canadian participation, banging particles together inside particle detectors. These particle detectors look a little bit like cylindrical onions, and each layer of this onion is designed to detect a different type of fundamental particle. How did we accelerate the particles to the high energies, the high velocities, before their collision? Well, I used to say that we use the same principles as your TV set. That, of course, was back in the days before flat-screen TVs. But those of you who are old enough, you may remember that TVs used to have vacuum tubes, and they used to have electric and magnetic fields, and those were used to guide electrons so that they collided with the screen and produced the picture. Well, that's, in some sense, exactly what we do with our particle accelerators, except what we do is we bang these TV sets against each other, in some sense. So this is a cross-section through a typical particle detector. Bob will be leading you later on through the specific ATLAS detector, which Canada is associated with. This is the rival detector. So I promise you won't see this picture again. So you have to imagine now the particles are going into the screen like this. And this is a slice through the detector. And it shows all the various different layers of this detector onion. So there's bits in the middle to measure the tracks of the charged particles. Then there's bits out here which absorb the energies of various different types of particles. Some particles go all the way through. Those are things that we call muons. And those muons you measure in big detectors on the outside of the apparatus. So the experiments that we've done with such accelerators, with such detectors, have revealed to us what we call the standard model of particle physics. It's a somewhat prosaic name, but it stuck. So this was first postulated in the 1960s by, in particular, Abdus Salam, whom you see in this picture, from Pakistan, by Glashow and by Weinberg. Crucial tests of this were done not only at CERN, but also at other laboratories around the world, such as Fermilab and SLAC in the United States, laboratories in Germany, Japan, and so on. All the experiments that have been done at these accelerators so far, all the confirmed experimental results, are in perfect agreement with this so-called standard model. And this is just one picture that I took from the previous round of experiments done at CERN. You may, if you've got good eyesight, see little black spots along here. Those little black spots are the experimental measurements, and you can see that they agree with this line here. This line is a line based on theoretical calculations. In fact, there's three different lines. That's the theorists hedging their bets. In fact, those different lines correspond to different numbers of elementary particles. And so using this sort of measurement, one can actually measure how many different types of elementary particles there are in total. OK, so what is this standard model? So on one slide, I'll show you what we know. So we've got these particles which make up matter. There are three different families or generations of these particles. And each of these families or generations contains two quarks, a neutrino, and an electron or similar particle. So this is a pattern that's repeated three times. We don't know why, but apparently God punched the number three on the cosmic Xerox machine. And the fundamental interactions between these particles, as I've already described, there's gravity, which bends space and keeps the Earth going around the sun. There's electromagnetism, which is what enables you to see this picture here. And there are the weak and strong nuclear forces, which, as I said earlier on, enable the sun to give us energy. These elementary particles constitute all the visible matter in the universe. So you can, in some sense, regard them as being the cosmic DNA, which somehow contain enough information to predict, you know, my existence, your existence. Now, in fact, as astronomers and astrophysicists tell us, in addition to the visible matter, there must also be in the universe invisible dark matter. And this invisible dark matter is one of the targets of the LHC experiments that we'll be discussing later on. OK, so we've got this standard model. It leaves open many questions. Let me just quickly run through some of them with you. One question is, where do particle masses come from? Another way of phrasing this is why do particles weigh? Why do particles weigh different amounts? Some particles are very light. Some particles are relatively heavy. Some particles don't weigh anything at all. Now, there's a theory for this, and this theory is due to Mr. Higgs, whom you'll meet shortly. Mr. Higgs has a particle. It's called the Higgs boson. And this is one of the principal things that we're going to be looking for with the LHC. We would also like to understand why there are so many different types of elementary particles. Why are there these three generations? Why does each generation contain two quarks, a neutrino, and an electron or something similar? What is this astrophysical dark matter, which I just mentioned? Is it possible to unify the fundamental forces? Is it possible to make a true quantum theory of gravity? Now, this is a particular interest here at the Perimeter Institute. What they are addressing, amongst others around the world, is the challenge of reconciling what you might regard as the two greatest achievements of theoretical physics in the first half of the 20th century, which were, on the one hand, Einstein's theory of general relativity, and on the other hand, quantum mechanics. We're now almost a century later, and we still don't know how to combine these theories. We've got some ideas about how to do it, but there's no proof yet of what that theory might be. Where might this proof come from? Well, conceivably from the LHC. The LHC will address all of these fundamental questions, and as we go through the rest of this talk, I will try to explain to you how it might do that. So let's start off with the problem of mass. So you might think that we know all about mass. You may remember hearing in high school that Newton told us that weight was proportional to mass. You may also remember that Einstein told us that energy was related to mass, the famous E equals mc squared. This is very true, but unfortunately, these two honorable gentlemen forgot to explain where the mass came from. They said how it could be related to other things, but they didn't give us the origin of mass itself. And that's where Mr. Higgs comes in. So here is Mr. Higgs, an extremely modest gentleman, who is in fact deeply embarrassed that the world's physicists are spending billions of Swiss francs to try to find his boson. There's his boson up there on the blackboard. And as I mentioned, it's this Higgs boson of his underlying his theory, which is in some sense the holy grail of particle physicists. Now, this is a little video clip which illustrates the idea. This is a particle here going through the Higgs vacuum. There's another one coming in a moment, I think. Yes, there it is. Okay. And as you saw, as that particle went through the medium, it clustered a lot of Higgs stuff next to it, and it's that clustering of Higgs stuff which gives you the mass of the elementary particle. Okay, so that's one of the things we're going to be looking for with the LHC. Now, there are other things that we're going to be looking for, and let me just mention one of them, which I find particularly interesting. And this is something called supersymmetry. Now, supersymmetry is something which actually was discovered by some colleagues of mine at CERN back in 1973. It's a very novel type of symmetry which would actually link together the particles of matter that I talked to you early on and the particles of force, things like, for example, the photon that carries light. Now, the point to remember here is that these different types of particles, the matter particles and the force particles, have different internal properties. In particular, they spin at different rates. So you have to imagine that each of these little particles, instead of just standing here, is actually going around in circles all the time. Now, different particles go around in circles at different rates. You have to think of them all as being ballet dancers doing pirouettes. And some of them go around relatively slowly, and others of them go around quite a bit faster. So the matter particles and the force particles pirouette at different speeds, and supersymmetry is the only known symmetry which could link them together. Now, there are also technical reasons for liking supersymmetry. It's not only beautiful, but it's actually useful, for example, for fixing the masses of elementary particles, helping us to unify the fundamental forces. And it could provide the dark matter which the astrophysicists and the cosmologists tell us that they need. So there are plenty of reasons for liking supersymmetry, and that's why, in fact, my own personal research time is often devoted to her. So I mentioned dark matter a couple of times. So let me discuss that in a little bit more detail now. Here you see a picture of a typical galaxy. So it's shining bright, but you see that it's surrounded by lots of dark matter. Indeed, every galaxy that we know about seems to be sitting in what's called a halo of dark matter, which contains something like 5 or 10 times as much stuff as is actually visible. We know from the gravitational forces on the visible stuff that there must be this additional visible stuff all the way around it. And maybe this is composed of these supersymmetric particles. So in the last year or so, there's been some dramatic observational evidence for this. This, for example, is one I like. This is where two galaxies have collided like this. And the dark matter doesn't interact, at least not very strongly. And these dark matter particles just went straight through each other. And that's what you see here. These are the clouds of dark matter which have gone through each other. On the other hand, over here, you see that in between these clouds of dark matter, there is some shining stuff. And that is dust and gas, which, when these galaxies collided, heated up. And you can see the hot gas there. So this is very direct observational evidence that, in addition to the visible matter, there is also invisible dark matter, which you can't see over here. In fact, all the visible matter in the universe exists in a sort of scaffolding of dark matter. And this shows you the distribution of dark matter in one particular direction in the sky, which was surveyed a few months ago. And the visible galaxies hang on this scaffolding and are actually a relatively insignificant part of the total matter in the universe. So clearly, it would be extremely important, extremely exciting, if the LHC could find this dark matter that dominates the universe. Another issue is the relationship between matter and antimatter. In the 1920s, Dirac, the theoretical physicist, used quantum mechanics and special relativity to argue that every known type of particle would have to be accompanied by an antiparticle with identical mass but opposite internal properties. And these opposite particles, these antimatter particles, were subsequently found in the cosmic rays and also produced in accelerators. Now, it used to be thought that these matter and antimatter particles would be precisely equal and opposite. Electron negative charge, positron positive charge, exactly equal and opposite. In fact, it turns out in accelerator experiments that they're not quite equal and opposite. Why? This may be related to the fact that in the universe as a whole, there is lots of matter. Clearly, we here in this room are all made of matter. In fact, our entire galaxy is made only of matter. In fact, our whole cluster of galaxies is made of matter. There's no visible amount of antimatter in the universe. So where did all the antimatter go? It may be that it disappeared because of this very small difference between matter and antimatter. So there are experiments at the LHC and elsewhere which are designed to look for this matter-antimatter difference, try to understand it better, and perhaps relate it to cosmology. I mentioned unifying the fundamental forces as a dream of particle physicists. In fact, it's been a dream ever since Einstein. And this is a rather touching picture. I showed you Peter Higgs's blackboard before. This is Einstein's last blackboard, where he did not succeed in unifying the fundamental forces. Maybe the LHC can give us some hints. Now, I've talked a lot about the LHC. I wouldn't like you to take away the impression that it's only experiments at the LHC which are interesting. It's true that there are many things that the LHC will be able to explore: dark matter, the origin of mass, and so on. But it's also true that there are many phenomena which occur at such incredibly high energies that one cannot access them directly using particle accelerators, at least not until we can afford an accelerator as big as the galaxy. So for the time being, until the economy improves, those things over on the right we leave to the astrophysicists and the cosmologists, and we particle accelerator people concentrate on the stuff on the left. So here is the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC. What you saw earlier on was a Photoshop impression of what the LHC would look like. Here you actually see real magnets in the LHC tunnel, 27 kilometers of tunnel. So what we're going to do with this is we're going to collide protons. We're going to collide them each with an energy of 7 TeV. I'll try to explain in more detail what 7 TeV means in a moment, You can think of it as being 7,000 times the rest energy of a proton. We're going to try to make collisions at a rate of a billion times per second. And each of those collisions will release enough energy to produce 14,000 protons. Of course, we don't expect that to happen. Maybe only a couple of hundred particles come out each time. But those particles, we hope, will give us insight into the origin of mass, the nature of dark matter, the matter-antimatter difference, basically tell us what the universe was like in its very early history. So here are a few LHC facts and figures. The circumference is just under 27 kilometers. The average depth is about 100 meters. The temperature of the LHC is 1.9 degrees above absolute zero. You may say, well, you know, we in Canada, we know about cold, right? But this is another 270 degrees colder. I said the protons have an energy of 7 TeV. That's the energy of 5 trillion AA batteries connected end to end. It's equivalent to, roughly speaking, the energy of 7 flying mosquitoes. Those protons are traveling at 0.9989, of the velocity of light. The total energy of the beams, because there's something like 10 to the 11 particles in each beam, is equivalent to that of a high-speed train. These beams, they may contain lots and lots of particles, but when they collide, they are focused down until they're narrower than a human hair. And this whole shebang costs about 4.6 billion Swiss francs. This is a little picture to convince you that indeed we do have a really cool place at CERN. In fact, it's so cool that it's colder than outer space. Our magnets are cooled down to below 2 degrees above absolute zero. For comparison, outer space, the radiation that comes to us from outer space, is 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. So this is why I say that the LHC is colder than the universe. So the installation of the LHC has taken quite a number of years. This is actually the last LHC magnet being lowered very carefully down into the tunnel 100 meters underground. And this is one of our technicians praying that he's putting it in the right place. So the installation of the accelerator is now basically complete, and we plan to start collisions next year. Now, I should mention that in addition to the European countries that pay for CERN, there's quite a number of other countries around the world that have also contributed to constructing the accelerator, notably Canada, and Bob will be discussing that later on. So here again is a general view of the LHC. So previously I showed you a picture from the air. Now I show you a slice through the land around Geneva. So there's the airplane accelerator over there. Here is the French-Swiss border going through here. Here is the tunnel, all 27 kilometers of it, and roughly speaking, 100 meters underground. And you see that there are four experiments around the ring. One of these experiments, the biggest one, is called Atlas, and that's the one which has Canadian participation. So this shows you images of the four experiments. Atlas, with the Canadian participation in the top right, ALICE, CMS, and LHCb. So I'll be concentrating in what I'm going to talk to you about, ATLAS and CMS, which are the ones looking for Higgs and supersymmetry, and then later Bob will go into more detail into the ATLAS experiment that you guys are involved in. So here is a cutaway of the ATLAS detector. So like I was saying earlier on, a typical particle detector has the structure of a cylindrical onion. The collisions take place in the middle here, and then the various different layers of detector on the outside enable you to identify the different types of particles. So it's pretty heavy. It's 7,000 tons. However, it's actually lighter than the Eiffel Tower. And if you wrapped ATLAS in a plastic bag, it would float. So here now is a sequence of images of the construction of the ATLAS detector. You can see the various pieces as they're lowered into the cavern and they're put together. These big things on the outside are components of the magnet, and you can see them gradually all being installed. And this is the last picture showing the complete magnet system. And if you look very, very carefully, you will see a person there. Okay, the whole thing is 25 meters tall, 50 meters long almost. It's large enough to contain the main CERN administration building, and many of us think that would be a very good place for it. Anyway, what you see here is also a hole in the middle of ATLAS, and that hole, Bob is going to tell you what's inside that later on. This is the other Higgs and supersymmetry discovery experiment. Another very international group of physicists are putting this thing together. It's somewhat heavier than the Eiffel Tower, and if you wrap this one in a plastic bag, it would sink in water. So here's a bunch of images of the construction of CMS. Again, you see various pieces being lowered into the cavern 100 meters underground. And actually, this is interesting. This is one of the detectors that's used to measure the energies of photons produced in collisions. And these are crystals, which also have potential applications in medical physics. Okay, so what are we going to do with all this? Well, we're going to find the Higgs boson, we hope. Okay? So here is a simulated event in CMS where a Higgs boson has been produced. So what's happened here? You've had what happened in the computer, right? You had protons going this way and this way. Two of these protons collided. They sent a whole bunch of stuff forwards and backwards. Some stuff came out at large angles. And among the stuff that was produced was a Higgs boson. Now, a Higgs boson is not a stable particle. It's very short-lived, and it decays into other particles. And so what you have to do is you have to look through all this complicated final states to look for the particular particles which are the signature of the Higgs. So can you spot the Higgs? Bob, you should be able to spot the Higgs. Okay. It decayed into these two particles over here, which deposited their energy in those crystals that I showed you just a moment ago. And it also decayed into these two particles over here, which are muons, which go out through the outer parts of the detector. So, okay, you can see it's very simple to find, right? Well, maybe not so simple. You need very powerful computers, and we'll come back to that in a second. Here is supersymmetry. Here is dark matter. The dark matter is over here, where you don't see anything. Instead, what you see is deposits of energy by the other particles that are produced. Now, you don't just lose energy. There has to be some other energy which balances what you see, and that is provided by the dark matter particles. And you have to work very hard to be sure that the energy was carried away by dark matter particles and there wasn't some problem with the detector or neutrinos or something like that. But it's reckoned both by ATLAS and CMS that they should be able to do that. Now, I said that maybe we could test theories of quantum gravity. So this is a very big maybe. But in some theories of quantum gravity, like the ones they're working on down at the Perimeter Institute, gravity, which normally we think of as being a very weak force at the level of elementary particles, maybe this gravity becomes strong when you collide particles with the energies of the LHC. And if gravity becomes very strong, maybe every once in a while, two quarks get so close to each other that they form a black hole, a microscopic black hole, much smaller than the ones that exist in the universe, but a black hole nevertheless, which then would decay through Hawking radiation. This would be extremely distinctive and extremely exciting if it happened, and it would be a wonderful laboratory for theories of quantum gravity. Okay, so this draws me to the close of my part of this presentation. I hope that I've convinced you that there are very close connections between the little bangs that we make at CERN and the big bang responsible for the universe. In particular, many questions about the material content of the universe, the nature of the vacuum, dark matter, the origin of matter, are addressed by experiments at particle colliders, looking for the Higgs boson, supersymmetry, matter-antimatter asymmetry, and so on. So there's a real symbiosis that we can not only learn particle physics from the universe, remember, many particles were discovered in the cosmic rays, but also we can use particle physics, such as what we do in our accelerators, to understand the way the universe works. So in some sense, not only is the LHC a microscope, but it's also a telescope. So at that point, I will stop, and I will hand you over to Bob.
So thanks, John. What I'm going to tell you about is a little bit about what the Canadians actually did, both for the accelerator and for the detector itself. And since you all paid for it, you have the right to see what we've done with your money. There are universities all across Canada, from Quebec all the way out to the Pacific Coast, who are working on this experiment, and also our national laboratory, Triumph. There are 41 university and lab physicists, over 120 people in the country working on it. And we try to play an educational role with summer students, graduate students, and postdocs. Maybe some of you here tonight who are young enough will be graduate students on ATLAS. So John described what the accelerator complex looked like, and this is the LHC itself. For technical reasons, before you inject the particles into the LHC, you have to pre-accelerate them in various other accelerators, and the one that Canada has contributed to is this one called the proton synchrotron. Now, the proton synchrotron was first operated in 1959, so after all these decades, it needed a bit of refurbishment. I think you can see that this is a 1950s photograph, maybe from the fact that it's black and white or something like that. So Canada worked on refurbishing this machine, and it's too technical to talk about the sort of things we did, but this is the proton synchrotron itself for injection into the LHC. And these green things are places where Canada contributed equipment. And the sort of thing we did was, there's a company called Interpower Controls in Burlington. They built power supplies for this machine. We built magnets for the transfer line from this little booster accelerator into the proton synchrotron. And we built various gadgets which stopped the accelerator from upsetting the national grid when it's running. All in all, the Triumph Laboratory contributed $14 million in equipment and about $6 million in salaries in this period up to 2000. And then from 2000 onwards, these magnets were built in Canada, in Montreal, by Alstom. And this was another contribution we made of roughly the same order. These magnets were made in Quebec and transported over to CERN, and they're used for injection from the superproton synchrotron into the Large Hadron Collider itself. So this is a different picture of the ATLAS detector from the one that John showed, and you can see the two little people standing here, which gives you the scale of it. And there are an enormous number of detectors there. These are the big magnets that John showed you being lowered down into the cavern, and these are big superconducting magnets also. What Canada did was we worked in this region here where we made things called calorimeters, which detect the particles. And this is a blow-up of that little cylinder I showed you just there. And the things that were made in Canada are these big wheels. You'll see pictures of them in a second. And this thing, which is called the forward calorimeter. And this is actually to detect forward products from the proton collisions. So this device itself has to survive in a very high radiation environment. And it's made out of essentially tungsten. So why do we call it a calorimeter? Well, probably it's a joke, actually. The way a calorimeter works is we have some metal. And if a charged particle hits this metal, there's a shower of other particles, and all the kinetic energy is turned into ionization, as it's called, in the metal. And to sample this ionization, we put some sensitive medium, and we use liquid argon. So it's not as cold as the magnets themselves, but it's quite cold. It's at 80 degrees Kelvin. And then this ionization is collected, and these electrical signals go down into a lot of electronics, and they're used to make these pictures that John showed of the events themselves. So this is what Canada made. It's called the liquid argon end cap, and the National Science and Engineering Research Council put about $15 million into this. And there's this big wheel, which is in a cryostat at 80 degrees Kelvin. And then this is the so-called forward calorimeter that sits inside it. So I'll show you a few pictures of this thing being built. So it, what was made in Canada, this part was made out in Triumph in Vancouver. The copper itself was machined at the University of Alberta on a big machine. And you can see that it's roughly what I described. There are these metal plates. This is copper. And there are gaps between the metal plates where the liquid argon is. And as the particles shower through this structure, you can detect their energy. So these wedges were made in Vancouver. And then they were transported across to Geneva by ship, actually. And we assembled them in Geneva. The whole thing weighs about 150 tons, the part that we built. And this is one, this is one of the wheels being assembled at CERN. And you can see it's almost finished. It's a big thing. And we assemble it horizontally. And then we have to tilt the whole thing vertically on this machine. And this machine was made in Oshawa, close to Toronto. And these are some of the people involved in building it. Actually, this was when the president of NSERC visited to have a look at what we were doing and seeing if we were producing value for money, I suppose. And this is the guy who leads Atlas internationally, called Peter Yenny. Oops. I haven't got the hang of this little thing, obviously. So this is the wheel which has been rotated into the vertical position on this machinery. And there are a couple of Canadian engineers smiling that they've achieved this without too much trouble. The other thing which was built in Canada is this thing called the forward calorimeter. And although it looks as if it's made of copper, it's actually made of tungsten. And we built this in the universities at Toronto and Carleton because we don't have so much space in the universities. And this thing weighs about 15 tons. It's 15 tons of tungsten mainly, and it has to be positioned inside the other detector with an accuracy of a fraction of a millimeter. And this is a photograph of this thing being installed. I showed you this before, but this was the end process of putting the calorimeters together. And then all of them go into this cryostat, and the end plate is welded on. It's filled with liquid argon. And then this whole assembly moves inside the detector itself. And this is what John showed you before, where you see these big racetrack magnets with the calorimeters installed in that space where he said he was going to put the administration building. The other thing you do is you have to process all this data coming out of the experiment. And Canada contributed one thing, which is the control chips on these boards. And there are thousands of these electronic boards around the experiment. And they detect all these signals, which are coming out a billion times a second. And we process them into some level where they're understandable. So these chips, this is the mask that the control chips were made from, which was made in the University of Alberta. And then another piece of data processing we've done was to work on this thing called the event filter. As John said, there's a tremendous amount of data comes spraying out of this experiment. If you know about these units, there's something like a gigahertz of is the event rate that comes out, and we have to reduce it down to something like 100 megabytes per second. And this is done in a multi-stage processing farm, as it's called. And the last part is just PCs, a farm of thousands of PCs. And Canada is working on the software of that, and perhaps paying for part of it. So once we have all the data, we have to process it down until we can see things like the Higgs boson and supersymmetry. And the amount of computing power that's necessary is beyond what any country could supply, or even CERN itself could supply. But it's a sort of tiered system where there's a large computer center at CERN called the Tier Zero, and then there are regional centers around the world called Tier One machines. And the Tier One center in Toronto, in Canada, is in Triumph, and the smaller sites are called Tier 3 sites or Tier 2 sites, and Toronto is one of them, and there are others at Carleton and Montreal, UVic, SFU, and then all this data comes out from all this cloud of computers to the individual physicists who are sitting down at their desktops trying to understand what's going on. Now, Canada is a big country, and it's quite sparsely populated, and it wasn't clear to us that we could actually do something like this, but we're very lucky that the federal government has actually sponsored this network of optical fiber across the country. And you can see this runs all the way from Victoria out to St. John's. And fortunately, It runs through all the Atlas Canada institutions, and this is what we use to communicate between the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 sites. And then the connection goes off from New York to the Tier 0 at CERN. So that's essentially all I had to say about it. I wanted to show you that with your money, we've been active participants in realizing this project, and we're keenly looking forward to participating in some of the discoveries that John's talked about. So watch out for the news in the next couple of years.
I don't mean to be pessimistic, but I can't help but think of what bad potential could happen from this. I keep thinking about when the first nuclear bomb was dropped in the world and they thought that it was going to vaporize all the oxygen in the atmosphere. I mean, can you allay people's fears with respect to that?
Well, actually, they didn't think it was going to vaporize the atmosphere. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let the thing off, would they? Likewise, we don't think that by starting up the LHC, we're going to create any problems. And the basic reason why I think you can sleep easily at night is because, as I mentioned earlier on, higher energy cosmic rays are hitting the Earth all the time. And in fact, they have been hitting the Earth for billions of years. And the Earth is still here. Nothing that we can make with the LHC would not have been made already by cosmic rays, or is being made by cosmic rays all the time. So, for example, I mentioned these microscopic black holes. So people say, ooh, black holes, you know. Yeah, it's real scary, right? These black holes are so incredibly tiny that they break up through quantum effects extremely rapidly, and there's absolutely no way that they could present any conceivable danger for anybody. So, I think you can sleep at night. I certainly sleep at night.
But in fact, people in CERN were so concerned about this in a way that they formed a study group, and they did study all the different possibilities and produced a big, thick report. And mainly it says what John says, that these sort of processes have been happening in cosmic rays all the time and nothing untoward has happened, so you can relax about it.
Question over here.
So in contrast to that question about maybe the negative outcomes of this, maybe about the positive outcomes, I remember out of high school I got into both physics and the pre-med course at U of W, and I don't regret my choice to pursue a career in medicine, but I do still have a keen interest in the physical sciences, and it's a real pleasure to attend this lecture. My question, or maybe my challenge, is for you to extrapolate or postulate beyond the theoretical physics of these experiments and maybe comment on how the results of the particle accelerator might down the line be applied to medical sciences or diagnosing or treating diseases.
Okay, perhaps I take that one. At CERN, of course, our core business is the fundamental physics. Okay, we're not in the business of creating applications. However, in order to get our fundamental physics done, we have to develop, deploy, use technologies which often just don't exist elsewhere. Now, it turns out that a lot of these technologies actually are applicable to medical science. In fact, CERN was one of the first places back in the 1970s to pioneer PET scanning, positron electron tomography. So for those of you who don't know about it, this is actually a medical application of antimatter. What you do is you put into the body an unstable nucleus that emits positrons, the antiparticles of electrons. These positrons then annihilate with electrons in the body to produce photons, which you can measure. And in that way, you can monitor precisely the internal functioning, for example, of the brain. You don't do any damage to the brain. The brain carries on working, if the brain works. But using these PET or positron electron tomography devices, you can monitor exactly, you know, the processes that are taking place. Now, clearly, you would like to do this by putting into the body the minimum possible amount of this special unstable substance. So you would like to have detectors on the outside which have the highest degree of sensitivity and also the most accurate position measurements. And so this is one of the sort of technologies that we've been developing. And in particular, I show this picture of these crystals which are being used in the CMS experiment. And these are one of the technologies that's being developed for this purpose. So that's one set of applications of what we do to medicine. Another set of applications is actually accelerators to produce materials which are useful in medical diagnosis. And people reckon there's something like 15,000 particle accelerators around the world, and somewhat over 10,000 of them are actually used for medical purposes. So this is a fantastic spin-off of the accelerator business. And perhaps the last application to medicine that I might mention is medical information. Increasingly, medical diagnosis is going to be based on images of the body taken with many different techniques, x-rays, ultrasound, PET scanning, or what have you. There's going to be enormous data banks of this information. Often you're going to have to combine images taken with various different techniques. And the sort of information technology, even the grid technology that we've been developing, has applications to this.
I'm here with my grade 12 university level physics class. And my question is, how do you think this technology is going to be evolving within the next few years as myself and my classmates leave our post-secondary school education and actually head out possibly into this field?
Bob. I could say something about that because experimental physicists, also theorists, already have ideas for what sort of machine would come after the LHC. There are already plans on the drawing board for a machine called the International Linear Collider, which again is a superconducting machine, but it collides electrons and positrons who are accelerated along a straight line, and it would be about 30 kilometers long. Now that machine, people won't actually finish the design of it or even decide to build it until we see what's happened at the LHC. But say, for example, the Higgs or something like the Higgs was discovered at the LHC, then you'd want a precise machine to do a precise study of how the Higgs behaved, to really understand whether it was a standard model Higgs or a Higgs that came from some extension of the standard model. So the most likely scenario at the moment, if you believe that we'll find a Higgs in supersymmetry at the LHC, is that sometime 20, 25 years from now, there'll be a new machine called the International Linear Collider, and one hopes there'll be a new generation of physicists like you that will be doing the precision studies of these objects. Now, if the LHC doesn't find these things, it depends on what it does find, and it also depends on how much it would cost to build something to elucidate these things. But I think there's a good chance that there will be another generation of people working in this field to elucidate what's happened at the LHC.
Yeah. So perhaps I could just add to what Bob said. I talked a lot about the Higgs boson, and the Higgs boson in some sense completes the standard model. It's the one missing ingredient that we haven't seen yet in the standard model. And I like to compare the situation to a room. So you imagine the standard model is a room and it has a door. So you could think of the door as closing up the room, but you could also think of the door as opening to what lies beyond the standard model, what lies beyond that room. And I'm convinced that when we open the Higgs door at the LHC, we're going to discover something outside. Now, I personally like the idea that it's supersymmetry. Some of my colleagues think it might be additional dimensions of space. Maybe it's something completely different. And I think whatever it is that the LHC finds, as Bob just said, will then set the agenda for what you would like to do with your next accelerator. And you mentioned this idea of the ILC, which is a front-running idea for what the next accelerator might be. Other people are discussing other ideas, and when we have results from the LHC in, let's say, 3 years' time, something like that, then we may have a better idea of which way to go forward. Maybe the ILC will be the way forward, but anyway, there will be some next accelerator.
There's one thing I'd like to add to that, and if you remember the slide that John showed where you see the energy reach of the LHC, and over on the other side of the slide there was the sort of cosmological scale, and there's many decades of energy between it. Essentially, we're using technology for accelerators, apart from the superconductivity, and even superconductivity was discovered decades ago. It would be great if there were people that were smart enough to invent new methods of particle acceleration so that you didn't have to build machines that were 30 kilometers long and ran at 1.9 degrees Kelvin. And one always hopes that these people are sitting out in the high schools in the world. There's somebody there who, not just a theoretical physicist, but an engineering physicist that will come up with some new ideas for particle acceleration. That's another hope I personally would have. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in physics, to do any kind of physics you like, whether theoretical or more engineering physics, because there's a lot to be done to elucidate this big region that John talked about.
On a more practical level, I don't imagine you just turn a switch on and get the accelerator functioning. Can you maybe explain the schedule and the sequence that you go through to get the unit operational up to speed? Even just the sheer power requirement to do that. And as an aside to the same question, what was the nature of the problem that occurred earlier in the year with one of the magnets? I don't quite understand that.
Which problem?
Oh, okay, well, maybe there was more than one, but.
Okay, so perhaps I'll discuss the problems, and maybe Bob would like to talk about, you know, how rapidly you expect the accelerator to be operating.
Sure, okay.
So the problems. So we got some magnets from the Americans.
Also the Japanese.
And the Japanese, as you say. But so you've got these collision points around the ring, and where the particles are brought into collision, I said that we have to focus down the beams so that they're narrower than a human hair. So we have special magnets there, and these special focusing magnets, some were built in Japan, some were built in the US, and then the Americans put them together in a magnet system called the inner triplet. So this triplet consists of three main magnets, one after the other. So we got all the stuff, we put it in next to the interaction point, and we tested it. Poof! So the first thing that went wrong was when we put these things under pressure, there's a sort of bellows inside there, which is used to transfer heat between the hot and the cool parts of the magnets. So this didn't stand the pressure properly. So we replaced this bellows, tried again. Poof! This time what happened was that when you put the pressure on, there was a longitudinal force along the line of the beam. And this had not been taken account of. And the magnets just were pushed apart. So in some places, this was called an explosion. Technically speaking, it's not an explosion because there is no release of chemical energy. In fact, there was one Spanish newspaper which on its website talked about the whole of CERN being destroyed. Well, I can assure you it wasn't. Anyway, this problem was fixed relatively simply, and all these inner triplet focusing magnets are now operational and no problems. Another problem we had was fingers. So this is an amusing one. So you've got all these magnets. These are metal tubes, and you cool them down, and then you heat them up again. When you cool them down, they contract. When you heat them up, they expand. And you have joints between these magnets where, let's imagine this is one tube, and this is another tube, and the so-called fingers, which come out from this tube, and they go around the other one, so that when they expand and contract, you maintain the electrical contact which is important for having the beam go around properly. So what happened was we cooled them down, so they went like this, and then we heated them up, and they were supposed to go back like that, but instead they folded up inside the tube. Those pieces of equipment we got from the Russians. So people were worried a bit for that all these fingers would be broken. But it turns out that only 1 or 2% of the fingers are broken, and you can easily figure out which ones and you can repair them. So it's not a problem. So right now, we don't have any big problems in mind. And so what's the schedule?
Schedule is that the machine is supposed to have circulating beams in late 2008. And I think there are several things you have to realize. One is that we have to make the machine work, and we also have to make the detectors work before we can do any physics. And obviously, the first thing is to have the accelerator working itself. And, you know, when you look at it, this machine is of almost unimaginable complexity. So there are all these different little parts and systems, like the things that John has talked about. And all of these have to be brought online. And they all have to be brought online and made to work without damaging the machine, because the stored energy in the beams is enormous. I was looking at one transparency that someone cooked up where they showed a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, and they were saying that the stored energy in the beams was something like 10% of the stored energy, the stored kinetic energy in an aircraft carrier. So you don't want to go up to high luminosity until the machine is very well understood. And it's complicated to understand the machine, because the way we usually describe them, we just talk about particles describing an orbit inside a magnetic field. But there are many nonlinear effects where parts of the beam affect other parts of the beam, and you can lose the beam. So it will take a while, maybe months, to actually understand how to bring the machine up to a design luminosity, but there's a lot of physics that we can start doing maybe in the first year or so after the machine turns on. But the main thing the physicists will be doing working on the detectors is trying to understand the detectors. Because one of the things that John said was, when he was talking about supersymmetry, that you detect it from missing energy. Well, it's very possible that what you think is missing energy in a big complicated detector like this is just that someone has knocked off a power supply, or a power supply is tripped off, or some part of the detector just isn't working properly, that cables have fallen out, or there are bad IC somewhere. So all this enormous system has to be understood and understood to be working correctly. And for example, the past generation of experiments like CDF at Fermilab in the United States, we didn't even start thinking about detecting missing energy until something like a year or 18 months after the accelerator started up. We spent that first year or 18 months just understanding the detector. Now, ATLAS is maybe an order of magnitude more complicated, but there are lots of people, and I think we've learned a lot from the past generations. So I would hope that within a couple of years, you might start to see really interesting physics coming out of it. It depends what's there. It depends what's there.
Perhaps I could just add to what Bob just said. A few months ago, I was showing around the LHC a consulting engineer. And this guy, you know, he'd been consulting for companies building nuclear power stations. He'd been consulting for Airbus. And he looked around and he said, you know, this is just beyond anything that he had seen before in a couple of different ways. One was just the sheer complexity and the diversity of the suppliers. So I already talked about Russia, Japan, the US. If you look inside the detectors, you've got bits coming from Pakistan. You've got bits coming from Brazil. Just the sheer complexity of putting all these things together is something he had not seen before. And the other thing is the precision. And we talked about ATLAS being almost 50 meters long and 25 meters tall. But that somehow doesn't capture the fact that the individual components inside ATLAS have to be localized at the micron level, so a few millionths of a meter. So it's going to take a while to understand it.
To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.